It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. I'm your host, Shelley Brisbane. This is episode 96, Employee's Entrance. Employee's Entrance, a 1933 pre-code film starring Warren William and Loretta Young. And Wallace Ford is in it, too. A very interesting movie that I inflicted upon my panelists because I love me some Warren William and also some pre-code. Not necessarily, well, yes, necessarily in that order. And so I think I know the answer to my usual question, which is whether people have seen this and how they feel about this movie, just as sort of a top line thing. But I'm going to go ahead and go around and ask Mickey Maynard, welcome to the show, first of all. And have you seen this movie before?
No, I am an employee's entrance virgin, so I was very excited to watch it, as one would be.
As one would be. Nathan Alderman, are you also an employee's entrance virgin?
I take issue with your use of the word inflicted. That would be like saying that you inflicted a suitcase full of gold bars on me, because this movie rocks.
Glad to hear it. Randy Dottinga, how about you? Are you feeling inflicted?
Well, I'm locked in the fourth floor men's lavatory at the Lions, Towers, and Shields headquarters. Can you let me out?
Could you fix it before you come out, though? That would be good.
So I do appreciate that you gave us a movie that's really fun to watch and not problematic in any possible way.
Oh, goodness, no.
Problematic, whatever do
and
you
it's
mean?
Like a, and it, yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's fast-paced. It's a delight until you watch it and then sit there and go, wait a minute.
Don't think too hard about the things that are problematic. I think that's a pre-code is often that way. A lot of times pre-code is just about the I can't believe they did or said that thing. And then some pre-codes like this one do that, but they also have things that are problematic to modern eyes and ears. And so we have to deal with that. But problematic in this movie comes in the form of one Warren William. We've seen him before in some pre-codes. He was an actor back into silent days, but then in the early 30s, he sort of found his footing as the villain in a lot of pre-code pieces. There's another movie called Skyscraper Souls that is often paired with this, which is the same kind of deal, except instead of running a department store, Warren William is running a skyscraper and making everybody's life miserable. And then eventually, after doing a bunch of these pre-code movies, he becomes Perry Mason. So if you want to get a little whiplash, watch a selection of Warren William movies. And most people may not know Warren William, but I delight in introducing him to anybody, any chance I get.
Yeah, I've said this before, but it's really weird that there is once a whole genre of movie where it was like, this man is a terrible person. He's a monster. He's the villain of the movie. Also, he's super hot, and ladies, you should be into him.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but better than Wallace Ford, I suppose. But he does have a certain charisma. He is in his late 30s at this point, and Loretta Young, who's his co-star, is 20. But you know what else is new? Not only is it the 30s, it's Hollywood, so it doesn't really matter. But had Randy or Mickey, had you guys seen Warren William movies before? I can't remember if you were with us when we saw.
He was in The Gold Diggers of 1933. He pops up in a whole bunch of movies, you know, probably as a character actor. But yeah, he was very familiar to me. I had never seen him in any of the Perry Mason movies, but yeah, I mean, I knew who this was.
He was new to me, and I don't think I've seen a Loretta Young movie before. And she's one of those, I think, as somebody said on a podcast, one of those weapons-grade winsome actresses that you keep introducing us to.
Entirely by accident, because I'm not a huge Loretta Young fan myself, but she ends up being in a lot of these pre-codes because whether it's winsomeness or naivete or whatever it is, she's sort of the perfect combination of victim and wide-eyed, excited innocent.
Well, she was in The Bishop's Wife,
yes,
the original, and she was in this movie called Come to the Stable that I think is, you know, my mother liked Loretta Young, and I think Come to the Stable's got Catholic, Roman Catholic overtones to it. And so I just always remember whenever someone would mention Loretta Young. Oh, yeah. Whenever anyone would mention Loretta Young's name, my mother would say, come to the stable.
Well, we can talk about it, but this movie has a lot of hidden resonance because of her history, being basically date raped by Cary Grant, and then
Clark
I'm
Gable.
sorry, I mean Clark Gable, and too
Was
many.
going to say that did not sound like a
No,
Cary Grant
not
movie.
Yeah,
Cary
too many CGs in the movies at that time. But
Grant.
yeah, and that and the in this movie she's basically, I don't know if you'd call this a date rape, but yeah, it seems like it was very similar to what would happen to her pretty soon after this in her real
In
life.
real
Yeah.
life, yeah.
So I was gonna launch into my limited, but I've got some Loretta Young trivia for you. So Loretta Young is one of three sisters who began acting in the silent era, and I think she had been in the business in some way or other since she was a little kid, but she had been acting in movies since she was something like 14. And she has two other lesser known sisters who are she was the star. I believe she's the youngest as well. And so she was playing parts older than herself since she was, 16 or 17, and being paired off with leading men who are considerably older than she was. She was, in fact, a devout Roman Catholic, which is interesting, as you say, considering her history. Right about this time, she is having a relationship with Spencer Tracy, an actor who was 33 and married. And there is a lot of, and believe me, I've read a lot of this because I'm a Tracy fan and have read most of the biographies. And they had this relationship that did, in fact, threaten his marriage, but that many accounts say was unconsummated, which seems kind of weird. One of the things they did was they went to church together because they both felt so guilty about what they were doing. It's like, okay. And then she ends up a couple years later, in 1935, she's on a movie called Call of the Wild with Clark Gable. And they essentially, in good soap opera fashion, end up trapped in a cabin together and either had a consensual relationship or, more likely, he date raped her, leading to pregnancy. And she has a kid, which she manages to cover up. She immediately puts the child up for, and actually, I'm not sure if she puts the child up for adoption. I think she finds a foster home for it. And then later on, she adopts the child back. So a couple years later, all of a sudden, single Loretta Young has adopted a baby. And much in the way that Joan Crawford did some years later, although not for the same reasons. And so I'm trying to remember her name now.
Judy.
Judy, thank you.
I've read Judy's autobiography, which is very, very interesting, because she was clearly Clark Gable's goddaughter, and they even pinned her ears back because it was so obvious that she was Clark Gable's daughter. But her mother never admitted that she was Clark Gable's daughter until much, much, much later in life. And she, wandered around people saying, "Oh, that's Clark Gable's daughter," and her mother would never talk about it, and then finally did. There's a lot of resentment in that book.
Right. And Loretta Young marries later in the 30s after she's adopted her own daughter back. But that was her attempt, I think. There may have been love in the relationship. I don't mean to say that there wasn't, but it was sort of an attempt to create a more normalized family. But yeah, Judy apparently, in addition to that book, I mean, she went on the talk show circuit. She talked about it a lot, even while her mother was alive and certainly after her mother died. And Loretta Young had a long life. And she was a famously devout Catholic. And a lot of the movies she did in the 40s, and she had a television show. And there was a point at which even her choice of roles, and this was considerably after this pre-code period, but her choice of roles was sort of evinced by her religious faith, which is kind of interesting.
Which is weird because the Bishop's Wife sounds like such a secular film.
Right.
So apparently when Loretta Young had her television show, she would make this very dramatic entrance in a beautiful gown coming down the stairs. And you were supposed to feel that Loretta Young was graciously allowing you into her elegant home in Hollywood. So she had a different image in the 50s and 60s than she did in these early movies.
I really like her.
You know, I joke a lot.
I love her in this movie. I think she's just shows a lot of range, and she's beautiful to look at, but also I think she just does a nice job with the performance, and I really enjoy seeing her on the screen. She's just a delight.
Yeah, she's luminous in this movie. I mean, knockout, gorgeous, but also she's a really good actress
Yeah.
here. She absolutely holds her own with Warren William. I really enjoyed her performance and I was surprised by how much I liked it, especially since there are so many people in this movie. I mean, Wallace Ford, he's fine. I mean, he's no John Lund, but he's no John Lund. But like Alice White and Warren William, everybody in this, so many people in this movie are performing at such a high level. I was really impressed to see 19-year-old when it's filming Loretta Young really holding her own with these folks and giving a wonderful, lively performance where she's really engaged with her scene partners.
She has this sort of thankless job, as women in this situation do, where you have an overbearing, not in a derisive way, but just the way Warren William plays is fairly overbearing of anybody he's going to be in a scene with, and also his character is that way. And so, and you also have a woman who is going to be, you know, taken advantage of and wooed by this older man, and that's a hard role for a woman, especially at Loretta Young's age, to sort of make her own. You know, she's not just a vessel into which all of this energy Warren William has and all this, you know, loathsomeness is put. She has this sort of wide-eyed thing going on at the very beginning. She has things she wants. She wants Wallace Ford for some odd reason. And then she, but she's, you know, she starts at the movie, and this reminds me of the movie that she worked on with Spencer Tracy, which I think we might do sometime, called A Man's Castle, where similarly she is basically very down on her luck and she's hungry when she meets the person that she's going to spend the rest of the movie with. And the same thing happens in A Man's Castle. And they're both hard luck depression cases in that movie. And in this case, she's, you know, come into this department store to basically hide out overnight until she can meet the guy who will hopefully hire her the next day. And she ends up meeting him, and that's Warren William. And then later in the movie, she becomes girlfriend and wife to Wallace Ford, who, you know, wants certain things out of her life. And then she becomes, you know, she gets into a situation with Warren William, drinks a little too much, and gets date raped. And yeah, she's interesting. And I think holding her own with Warren William is a pretty spectacular feat for somebody of her age.
I find it less weird that she wants Wallace Ford than that Warren William wants Wallace Ford. It's that
There's
is
that, yes.
real interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, so Wallace Ford is this up-and-coming guy who works at the department store, and he has a couple of ideas, whereas all the older fuddy-duddy banker-type guys who Warren William is ostensibly either working for or who are assistants, they don't have any ideas. They just want to do things the way everything has been done. And Warren William says, "Who's got ideas?" And Wallace Ford does have ideas. And so Warren William essentially wants to adopt him as a son or something. And yes, there are definitely homoerotic overtones of some kind, which is super interesting.
Yeah, I think one of the things I really like about this movie is that it's the Depression, and we know it's the Depression. And people did things during the Depression that maybe they wouldn't have done after the war in the 50s, whatever, and also wouldn't be allowed to be shown on screen. But her desperation is very real. And I mean, we know that she sleeps with him and then gets the job as a model, and then we know that the man who becomes her husband is really ambitious and wants to climb because he wants to climb out of d the depression and also avoid getting fired because he's firing everyone.
Yeah, Warren William will fire anybody at the drop of a hat. The interesting thing, I read several articles about this movie that I think have excellent takes and sort of somewhat differing takes even. There's some that say, well, Warren William is the villain because he's mean to people and he fires them and he just has horrible, you know, smash or be smashed, and he has no sympathy for anyone, including the guy who commits suicide, and he basically says, if you're useless, you should go ahead and kill yourself. And he does all these, doesn't says all these terrible things. But at the same time, he is fighting against the entrenched bankers who are not doing anything to make the department store move forward, in either in terms of the depression or, you know, previously. And Warren William there has been there for something like 10 years, and sales kept increasing until the depression happened. And so Warren William is very angry, very, he doesn't have any respect for the bankers that he ostensibly works for, and the blowhard who runs the store, who spends his time yachting and being on the mayor's welcoming committee. So it's super interesting, because you can either think of Warren as just the straight up only villain, or you can say he has a single-minded passion for a thing that we might not agree is warranted, but at the same time, he's kind of got the number of the pompous dilettantes that he works for.
Yeah, he's a really fascinating character, because on the one hand, this man is a rapist. He's a terrible person. He does not care if people live or die. He will fire you for no reason, basically. But at the same time, he's portrayed as genuinely caring about whether thousands of people lose their jobs. He will fire one person individually and not blink an eye. But he seems really worried about, you know, the thousands of people who work for the store being out on the street. It's such an odd but such an interesting choice for the movie.
So I have a question for you all. I think at some point in the movie it said that there are 12,000 people that work in this department store. Do we think it's that one store or a chain?
I wondered about that. All we know is that the store has at least 9 floors, which is quite big. But even so, 12,000 people in one store, even assuming that you had a couple of shifts, that's a right. lot of people.
Yeah, and also the store, you know, has revenues of $100 million in 1929, which translates to $1.8 billion. Of course, I had to look at it. It just, these numbers just seem wrong. Even if it's Macy's, you know, even if it's Marshall Field in Chicago, I don't think they had that many employees. And I mean, across the chain, sure. You know, but you wouldn't have revenues like that in that time in history from a single store. So I was just,
you don't realize that 11,000 of them are models that the boss hired. So,
well, I mean, you've got the folks down in the warehouse and the trucks coming in and out. You've got the folks on the upper floors who aren't, you know, part of the store itself, but who are doing the bureaucracy to keep the store mm-hmm. running. And we don't know how big those floors are. This shop could be on an entire city block. So I guess it's possible. And I think, was it $100 million or
$100,000? It was $100 million.
No, $100 million.
Yeah.
I think, so this, remember we have had a couple of other movies where very large numbers get thrown around and the audience is just supposed to go, oh yeah, big number, you know, without it really making any sense. I think it happened on Fifth Avenue is one of those instances where, you know, cars cost $58,000 in, you know, 1940 or whatever. And there's just no way that a car costs $58,000. So that's what I'm thinking, is that these are just big numbers so that the audience gets the breadth and the size of the store, but they aren't meant to really be, you know, real numbers.
Yeah, you didn't have Google around to figure out how much a store would make.
It makes sense to me. And the 12,000 employees, that just sounds like a daunting number. I mean, even if you said 1,000 employees in one building, for some reason that wouldn't sound as impressive. And you remember when we see the department store, there are these establishing overhead shots of this huge floor and many people working around on the floor. And remember, mm-hmm. like, this is in the days when there were, and I'm sure Mickey, you'll have more to say about it, about sort of the way department stores were organized at that time. But this was in the days when you didn't just sort of go to shelves and racks and shop on your own. You go to counters and you say, this is a thing that I need. And there's an employee or more employees than one waiting there to help each individual customer. So probably the amount of people that you needed and the way they structured the store in order to find room for them was greater than it is, certainly than it is today. But I don't know if 12,000 is a realistic number.
Yeah. And I actually, when I started working in the department store in high school, we had models.
Really?
And I knew the models. Yeah, they're very nice ladies. We had a couple of ladies that were the house models for the store. And so if, say, Oscar de la Renta was doing a trunk show, the ladies would come and then they would walk around the store in Oscar de la Renta, and they had a little card that said Oscar de la Renta. And then you were supposed to go up to designer, and then I don't know if Oscar ever came, but someone from Oscar came, and then they would take your order for whatever the outfit was that that the model was wearing. And my mother worked at Marshall Field in Chicago, and Marshall Field had lots of models. And they, there, it's funny, there's a Marshall Field sort of fan page that I follow on Facebook. And some of the ladies who were models at Marshall Field every so often will post on the Marshall Field fan page. So models were definitely a thing in upper class department stores.
I was just pleasantly surprised by how very funny this movie was. Incongruously funny, considering, again, some of the plot points are suicide and rape. but it struck me like watching scenes with Alice White and the lovable, you know, addlepated cousin of the store owner cozying up to each other. These people are cartoons, but it's really fun to watch them be cartoons. They are very enjoyable cartoons to watch. And I was struck by that balance, that way of saying, yeah, we know this is silly, but we're going to have fun with it anyway. Seeing that in a movie with so many serious and dark topics is quite an experience.
Yeah, it's true. And you have the Alice White. I love the Alice White character because her first thing to do is go and seduce the cousin of the store owner so that he can be basically out of the way. And she can't seduce him because all he wants to do is play chess. And then later on, and that's actually, that was the first point. I was like, is the point going to be that he is coded as gay in some way? No, he's just an old guy who is, you know, a nice guy. I don't know, whatever. He wasn't interested in her. And then later on, she potentially becomes Warren Williams, girl who's going to go off to Paris with him. But that when Warren thinks he's going to lose the store, and then when he gets the store back, he immediately forgets about it. And then we can talk about dogs in a minute. but I just, it's so interesting because, you know, that the character of the quote unquote floozy, however you want to refer to her, she's funny. Like, she's not just an object. She does things that one for which she is objectified, but she is on her own funny.
I liked her a lot too, and she actually seemed like almost the more fun character, which is, of course, she is the comedy relief in this movie. But, you know, I was thinking if you put this movie into a Broadway musical, that they would give her some kind of a song on her own.
Yeah.
Where she's surrounded by chorus boys and, you know, she's talking about what she has to do to, you know, to make her way up in the store or something like that.
Oh man, now I desperately want to see this as a musical.
It would be such a good musical.
It would be great, but I do love that she's not stigmatized. We're not shown like this is a bad person and you should dislike her. She's just trying to do what she needs to do to make a living and get by. And the movie never shames her for that or you know, dumps on her, except in ways that are, you know, good natured and funny.
Well, if you think about the Jean Arthur character that we saw, you know, earlier this season, that the fur coat just falls out the window on her, and then all these things happen, and she doesn't really agonize over them. They all just sort of happen. And I think Polly is working it a little bit more than Jean Arthur was, but I also think that Polly is just kind of breezing through, like, if, you know, if it was 20 years ago, Catherine Zeta-Jones could play her and just kind of hustle her way through the movie.
Oh, she's absolutely working it, and the movie wants you to admire her for that, because she's smart and intrepid in her own weird, morally compromised way.
Yeah, and there's really nobody moralizing in the movie. There's no little old ladies tut-tut-tutting. Warren William doesn't have a wife at home who's causing him to be, you know, who's nagging him in any way, which, you know, maybe Warren William could use somebody to chill him out a little bit, but not necessarily a nagging wife. This all these characters are doing what they're going to do, and you're allowed to decide who you like and who you don't without the sort of, you know, overarching, well, this is the moral thing. Loretta Young shouldn't put herself in the position. I mean, yes, it's terrible what Warren William did to her, but we don't have to waste any time saying, well, if she hadn't gotten drunk and hadn't gone up there with him, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah, it's unambiguously presented as an evil thing that Warren William does,
yes.
Not her fault in any way, shape,
right,
or form. But I do also like that even the wacky, bumbling cousin ends up being like, ha ha, Warren William, you're a monster, but we're pals anyway. And Warren William's like, shut up, I hate you. Ha ha, buddy, let's do this thing together, whatever.
Yeah, I don't like you. I don't like you either. Yay!
It's good. Well, did you all see They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, I mean, that's much darker than this
movie. Oh, yeah, very much so.
But you know, it's the Depression, and people did things during the Depression to survive, and they might not do them later, but at this point in time, it's a choice between having a roof over your head and eating or not, and a lot of people did not.
I feel like if anything, this movie should be darker. It should be a lot darker. And the fact that it isn't, that it's so breezy and fun, really kind of gives you pause. I mean, I had to check to make sure. Ayn Rand's first screen credit as a screenwriter isn't until 1941. Because I'm watching this and going, did Ayn Rand write this? You have a main character who is like, yes, I will crush everyone in my way. And, you know, and the only thing he respects is someone standing up to him and saying, you're a monster. I hate you and I'm going to destroy you. To which Warren William responds, great, I'm promoting you and giving you a raise. Definitely a technique I'm going to use at my next performance review.
And literally he says to the bankers, you're not producers, which is very much like Ayn Rand's, you know, takers and looters and all that stuff. And yeah, it absolutely felt like that to me. And I didn't check. I knew she hadn't written this, but it did seem like something that she would have absolutely loved and co-signed. And even to down to the William is better than the bankers, who may have all the money, but they have, whether they once were producers or not, they're resting on their laurels and they're preventing other people from doing actual productive things by controlling the money in some way. And I say bankers, also the people who own the department store but are essentially figureheads, and who, mm-hmm. you know, who say Alinsky would have rid of Warren William because he's bad, and then basically they figure out he's making them a lot of money, and Warren William says, not only are you going to keep me, you're going to pay me double, and they're like, okay, let's do that.
Yes, because we all know that capitalism is solely motivated by ethics, never by making money. But I do like to imagine a young Ayn Rand sitting in a movie theater watching this and just going, yes, yes.
I want Warren William in my first screenplay. She's like, because he can be like in some of his pre-codes, Warren William is mostly about being a rake and being, you know, cruel toward women. I mean, certainly there are other movies like Skyscraper Souls and like The Match King, where he is ruthless in business, but the sort of personal stuff he does is more of the movie. And this movie, you can tell that whatever he's doing in his personal life, the thing that animates him is business. And he tells the small bit of the story to Wallace Ford about how he was terribly poor when he was young and that he was motivated to achieve, but that he really seems entirely fueled by this desire to make money and smash or be smashed. And that's, it feels like if you took that away from him, like that, the one point at which they threatened to take it away from him is when he says to Polly, hey, let's go off to Paris. And you sort of get the feeling that if they did that, even the moment that they got on the ship, he would be looking for some other kind of deal, because he just doesn't seem like the sort of guy that, other than a one-night stand, could be happy doing anything other than practicing incredibly rapacious capitalism.
Well, if you think about Dodsworth, which we just talked about, you know, Sam Dodsworth is really excited about getting on an ocean liner and going over to Europe. And I just can't imagine Warren Williams sitting still that long, you know, for a 5-day voyage across the sea.
I'm the captain of this boat now. Anyone have a problem with that?
He would fly in an airplane. I mean, we were talking about, you know, why didn't they have an airplane to go to the Isle of Mull in, you know, I know where I'm going. I mean, no, that was the 40s and it was wartime, but I could see him going out to an airport somewhere and saying, get me to Paris. I don't know how long it's going to take or how you're going to do it, but get me to Paris.
Do you think that Loretta Young and Wallace Ford have a future?
I think they do, unless he gets weird about her and Warren William at some point, because that's the other way this could have gone. Like, he learns what's happened and he's freaked out at first. But the movie ends with the typical happily ever after, blah, blah. And we don't waste time sort of dealing with what his moral qualms might be and you're soiled or whatever. I can't marry you. So if that is truly well and truly over, and if he can find himself some other kind of job since he's quit Warren William now, I guess they'll be fine. I confess that I don't really care that much.
Yeah, it seems kind of secondary, you know, just that also Wallace Ford doesn't come across as a very powerful or interesting character. I mean, he's just kind of basking in Loretta Young's glow.
I mean, I like that he has ideas of his own, and I like that he's the one person in the movie who sees a halfway decent side to Warren William. The film has this interesting sympathy for William's character, where they're showing that he's this sort of hollow figure. He doesn't have anything except his desire to smash, keeping him going. And Ford's character, his view of William brings out a more sympathetic side of William's character, because whether Ford is seeing something that's really there, or Ford is just a decent enough guy and believes that there's good in this absolute monster, I don't know. But either way, I think it complicates William's character in a very compelling way.
I'm wondering how this movie would have been different in the postcode. What would have been taken out or toned down or just different.
The rape, probably.
I don't think she would have slept with him at the beginning of the movie either.
I think they might have gone out, and there might have been something vaguely transactional about, hey, I had a nice time with you, come back tomorrow and I'll give you a job. And the fact that they knew each other before would not have been known to Wallace Ford. And so even if they alighted over the sex part, you could have had Ford be, and probably what they would have done was, as I said, have the moralizing part where Wallace Ford is just like, I can't deal with this. The fact that you went out on a date with Warren William and didn't even tell me before we were married, that's horrible. And in the postcode world, that's enough.
Well, and also he would not have been allowed to express as much contempt for marriage. He would have said something like, marriage is not for me. You know, I believe in business, blah, blah, blah. But he would probably have never said that that women hold all of this terrible power over their husband. He might have been wistful about, oh, you know, my parents had a wonderful marriage, but then my dad died and my mother had to struggle, you know, or something like that. They would give a little bit of softness, unexpected softness. Yeah.
Or maybe he gets a backstory where he had a wife who was untrue to him or who died or who for some reason soured him on the idea of marriage, but it's really specific to his own circumstances.
Also, I think he probably wouldn't have been like, hey, Polly, want to come to Europe with me? When I get bored with you, I'll pay you off and we'll part as friends.
That's one of my favorite pre-code bits. It's like honest, which is why it disappointed me that when they didn't go to Europe together, he didn't say keep the clothes, because I wanted him to say, look, it's off. I got my store back. I'm really sorry, but you can have those clothes, because it's no skin off his nose, because he's not cheap. Like the point that they make about his style of running the store is he's from the banker's point of view, he's a spendthrift, but he's operating under the premise that you have to spend money to make money. And he doesn't want money wasted particularly, but there's no other place in the movie where he seems cheap. And I just wanted him to let Polly keep the outfits.
I think that was funny, though, because it's like the moment he gets the store back, there is nothing else in the world. He does not even remember that he has made this offer. He does not understand why she is in his office with a tiny dog. He does not know what a dog is. He probably has never seen a dog before in his life. And my God, the way he picks up that poor little dog and looks at it as if he is trying to appraise its market value and whether he can sell it and how many of them he can sell is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in a movie. And then he drops it in the wastebasket.
He drops the dog in the wastebasket.
I have seen this before, but I really didn't remember that. And so I was very startled when I saw it again.
That has lived rent-free in my head ever since I saw this movie weeks ago. Every time I think of this movie, it is Warren William holding a Pomeranian at arm's length and going, what is this and can I sell it?
I have to say that, you know, having worked in a department store, you see almost no one selling anything in this department store. And we know that they put the men's boxers the men's boxers next to the women's department, I think, because they think that women buy underwear for the men. But you don't see any actual transactions. You know, it's a department store with 12,000 people and no actual sales.
I wonder if
quoted for truth.
I wonder if postcode that there would be so much discussion of brassieres.
Brassieres and men's shorts, yeah, and the fourth floor lavatory, all sorts of undergarment related conversation that, at least in the volume that you see in this movie, you wouldn't expect to see either in postcode or most precodes, frankly.
I was wondering about the line. Well, that I was fascinated by the toys that he's playing with toward the end. And actually, mm-hmm, in IMDb, in the, I think it's the trivia section, they actually like list what each toy is and how much they cost back then and how much you can still get them for today if you get like a vintage toy. But they have that line where don't say it's made in Germany, say it's made in Japan. Mm-hmm. It will sell more. And I was like, this is 1933, what's going on with that line?
Well, maybe it is a reference to Hitler, an indirect reference to Hitler.
It's Japan kind of that you choose instead of like Switzerland or something.
Right. Well,
and nobody knows about all the murders that Japan is committing at this point.
Well, and toys made in Germany actually work. I mean, even today, toys made in Germany are considered to be very, very elite toys.
Well,
made in Japan became the sort of saying for cheap stuff.
Right, later.
But it just was one of those lines where you're like, ooh, there's a little politics right there.
So this was apparently released between the election and when Roosevelt was inaugurated, which is a really interesting time. Because I think one of the pieces I read said, by the time this movie was released, the American public had decided to throw out Hoover, but they hadn't done it yet because the new administration hadn't taken over. So it's a really interesting time in terms of the Depression.
And there's a interesting side story about Alice White. Right around this time, I don't know if this was before it came out or after, she had a scandal. And apparently she had gone out with a British actor who had beaten her. And she had required cosmetic surgery. And after that happened, she and her screenwriter, she and her fiance, a screenwriter, supposedly arranged to beat up the actor who had beaten her up. So it's this kind of complex story, and apparently
a little Tanya Harding thing.
It sounds like
there.
It, yeah, and it sounds like that this ended up hurting her career for a few years, and it sounds like her career never got to quite the extent that it could have.
I don't know, that would have made me more likely to hire her.
Yeah. And also says here that she was a script girl for Joseph von Sternberg early in her career. And I'm always looking at no one from this movie is still alive, but
oh thank God.
But
thanks for tricking.
Not anymore, thanks to Randy. He's been making some discreet visits over the past few years.
I've made some inquiries. But the man who played the Commodore's cousin, he actually died in a car crash before the movie was released. Sad to say. And the one of the characters ended up living to the age of around 99. And he was Mr. Pigskin, the Jewish customer who did not want to buy a football, actually made a pig in that.
Yet another just funny random little bit that didn't need to be there, but it was really entertaining. I was like, did they just really do that?
Yeah, and
I also really enjoyed that the one villain in this movie that Warren William can never defeat is the fourth floor men's lavatory.
Right.
That, you know, no matter how awful he is and how much he triumphs everywhere else, the fourth floor lavatory will always be there haunting him. And I love that it's so satisfying to see him get even that tiny bit of comeuppance, because otherwise he does not face any consequences whatsoever for this movie in which he drives a man to suicide and rapes a woman and is celebrated for it with raises, promotion, wealth, and adulation.
And he also suggests when the Commodore's cousin is trying to figure out what to do about Alice White, William says, why don't you kill her?
And he means it
several times, and he means it.
You absolutely know that this man means it.
I think he might be a sociopath. Just a theory.
Just a theory.
Putting that out there.
Might be a sociopath if.
Also, you know, he drives Loretta Young to drink poison.
Oh, yeah.
And at the end of the movie, she is lying in a hospital room with a sheet over her face because apparently her mouth has been so badly burned she can't speak. We're told she's going to be okay.
She'll be fine. It
seems
okay.
Like there ought to be some consequences for Warren William for that. But nope, he's just back on top of the world.
And you think Wallace Ford might be a little... I mean, at one point, Wallace Ford tries and fails to shoot him, but then he gets to, you know, he goes to... Essentially, he's basically, you know what I'm going to do is quit. And he leaves and he goes to be with Loretta Young, who is going to be fine, but isn't fine right now.
And this movie makes a weird argument that if you're dealing with a sociopath, treat him like a sociopath would. And he'll be like, oh, okay, I respect that. Oh, you shot me in the arm? That's cool. I would have done that too. We're pals now. We're square. Oh, you want to destroy me? Excellent. I can recognize that and appreciate that impulse. Here, have money.
Well, who does this remind you of? You know, not to interject politics into... the whole discussion, but we know who that is.
Yes, we do.
Actually, no, because Warren William has some sense of loyalty and does see other people as human vaguely.
He admires somebody who's going to be like him and will reward them and perhaps stay loyal to them as long as they don't cross him.
Yes, Warren William actually has someone's... That's the really interesting thing about this film. You would expect him either to be bad at his job, and he's not. Because, like, look at, like, Elon Musk, rich guy, thinks he's hot stuff, terrible at literally everything he does. But Warren Williams is really good. And you would expect him to, like, not care about anyone or care more about himself than anyone else. But it doesn't seem like there's anyone there for Warren William to care about. So he cares about the business because, like, there's no him there. That's really interesting to me about his character. Like, he's not in this for himself. There is no himself. He's an empty shell. He is the department store, and he cares about the department store because without it, he's nothing.
Right, and you get the sense that he doesn't really have much, besides the fact, you know, he finds and sleeps with women to meet his physical needs, but you don't get the sense that he lives lavishly or that he enjoys the perks of, you know, what he's made, other than offering Polly the chance to go to Paris, which, again, I don't think he would have kept up with if he had any chance to do anything else. I get the sense that he probably lives in sort of an unfurnished room and isn't there very often.
Yeah, it's just such an interesting and sympathetic portrayal of this terrible, terrible person. He's not just a one-note villain, and Warren William can play that, and it would have been fun to see him play that. But the added depth and complexity and just sheer weirdness that the movie gives this guy makes it so much richer.
So I was thinking about some of those movies, the Jimmy Cagney movies and the Humphrey Bogart movies, the 20th century, you know, some of those shoot 'em up, bang, bang movies of the early 30s. And those guys were ruthless, too. And so if you have ruthless gangsters on screen, it's fine to have a ruthless department store owner on screen.
Sure. And usually the gangsters would, well, one of the gangsters would probably end up shot. Like, you know, Jimmy Cagney in Public Enemy ends up being tortured and murdered at the end. But there are other people in that movie who do bad things that don't get that kind of comeuppance. But the gangster movie, the sort of end is more direct. It's you live by the gun, die by the gun. But in a thing like, in the case like this, yeah, Warren William just sort of, you know, walks free to and not only does he walk free, but he's going to continue to do what he's already been doing. It's not like he says, you know what, this department store is done for me, I'm going to go to Paris. He doesn't. He's going to keep running that store.
No, see, Shelley, this is legal capitalism as opposed to illegal capitalism. Totally different things.
It's
this
true.
Is good.
Again, back to Ayn Rand we go.
I mean, the only person that really has a permanent punishment is the store detective who's got to pay $10 a week for a grand piano for the rest of his life.
Alan Jenkins!
Alan Jenkins. Good old Alan Jenkins in a fairly early role. Let's see. What else is it? Oh, I mentioned Skyscraper Souls earlier, which is another movie where Warren William is a baddie. The comparison with that movie to this one is that movie was made at MGM. So this movie has sort of the gritty Warner Brothers values and approach, whereas Skyscraper Souls, they kind of dress it up a little bit. And I don't remember the end of that movie. It's been a while since I've seen it. I remember liking this one better than I like Skyscraper Souls, but that sort of MGM gloss and polish is more in evidence in Skyscraper Souls, which is why I'm so glad that Warren William worked for Warner Brothers a lot more than he did for MGM. Any final thoughts about employees' entrance? I think we all liked it. That's good. We picked well. I should say this breaks kind of a rule that I know other incomparable shows have, and it's a good rule, but I break it because sometimes I forget. This movie is not currently streaming. It is shown on TCM, and it is available on disc, most prominently in the Forbidden Hollywood No. 7 box set, which also includes Skyscraper Souls and an Edward G. Robinson movie called The Hatchet Man from 1932, which is interesting, except there's some yellow face in it that makes me a little uncomfortable. But Skyscraper Souls and Employee's Entrance, definitely worth seeing. And again, I cannot tell you that it is streaming right now, but things come and go. And this is, Forbidden Hollywood is distributed through Warner Archives, so it's not out of the question that this movie would be available streaming in some regard, but your best chance of seeing it is probably buying the Forbidden Hollywood set.
It just happened to be on TCM's online streaming. It's now off of streaming, but it was on the other day when I watched it. So, and I think it was also available on Hulu, but it looks like it's no longer there either. So it may come and go.
Yeah, keep an eye out for it. I just keep thinking that this is a musical, that it's either a movie musical or a stage musical, and there's just so much to it that you could have fun with. I mean, even though his character is completely despicable, there are ways to deal with that. I mean, he could be despicable, and then, as we know, every drama someone has to change, so at some point he'll change at the end, and we've got two women, we've got a romantic woman lead, and then we've got the plucky heroine, or secondary woman, supporting woman, and that could be just so much fun on the stage. You get your willowy sort of Sutton Foster lead type person, and then you get a plucky little blonde something that could tap dance. I mean, I just like this movie as the as a plot of a musical. So if anyone in New York is looking for things to put on the Broadway stage, check this movie out.
I agree. And I think the Alice White song would be the best song in the whole thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It would be, dare I say it, a smash.
A smash.
A poison could develop a cold.
Love it. Kristen Chenoweth could do it, although I know she's like more of the America sweetheart type these days, and maybe she's a little old, but I can see her doing it. In fact, I kind of want to. Well, friends, thanks so much for joining us for Employees Entrance, which is the last episode of Lions, Towers, and Shields for the spring season. We will be back for another series of 7 films in the summer season, and we have a theme, but it is still in process, so I will leave you to watch the social media for any information that I might share about the theme before we actually start releasing episodes. I believe it is in late June that we'll start, but for now, there are 95, believe it or not, episodes of this show that you can go back and listen to. So surely you haven't listened to all of them while you wait for the summer season to come along. There is stuff out there you can check out. If you go to theincomparable.com/LTS, you can find all of our episodes. You can also write LTS@theincomparable.com. And you can find us on social media at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Bye now.
Don't forget to fix the fourth floor men's lavatory.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.